Great. Thank you, Nathaniel, and thanks to all the organizers. It's been super fun being here. So I want to talk about Methuselah and the lifetime frontier. The things I'm going to say, the story is, so just by way of context, the story is sort of influenced by a white paper that we're about to put in the archive sort of a week from now, which is the Methuselah physics case. And also another white paper that the LHC-LLP community is putting out in the next order 1 months, one would think, which is more concerned with some of the nitty-gritty long-lived particle searches at the LHC. But the point is, these two, the development of these two things gives us a sort of very nice general framework for talking about the motivation of long-lived particles in general. So I'll be using the Methuselah physics case and parts of this to sort of guide the story, but a lot of what I say applies verbatim to many of the other long-lived particle detectors and lifetime frontier in general. It just sort of makes it easy to lay it all out. So I'll very briefly give a sort of zoomed out of why we should look for long-lived particles at the LHC. I don't think many people here will need much convincing of this. I'll then talk a little bit about the Methuselah detector and trying to compare it in a very, very general way to the main detectors and why it's good and what it's not so good at and so forth. Then I'll sort of flash a dozen plots at you about the incredibly impressive physics reach and various kinds of theories, which stitch together to form a big picture argument for how fundamentally motivated these searches are at the long lifetime edge. I'll say very briefly something about cosmic rays and then about the experimental timeline. Good. Okay, so why should we look for long-lived particles at the LHC? And we've heard all these things before, but it bears repeating. So number one is analogy to the standard model. Long-lived particles are a bit unfairly called exotic signals, but in the standard model, there's lots of exotics, B quarks. The Higgs even is quite long-lived. It travels for a proton radius before it decays. That's much longer than it should. Yeah? So there's all kinds of ways that you can suppress the decay width, and they happen in BSN theories as well. So there's a bottom-up theoretical motivation. Things like hidden valleys are very generally motivated by the sort of symmetry-based structure of quantum field theory. The Higgs likes to talk to all these things. So this is all sort of very strong plausibility arguments. This leads to the pragmatic argument, which is that we haven't seen anything else so far, so we want to look under all the available lampposts if we like our jobs, and I do. But I mean, this is pragmatic and a bit based, but it's absolutely true. And this is where I want to sort of point out that the LHC is a really excellent tool for the lifetime frontier, because the lifetime frontier is sort of, in some sense, it's almost a Venn diagram intersection of intensity and high energy. Because for many of these long-lived states, the thing that makes them long-lived is a small portal or an energy barrier between two portals, like a heavy mediator. The same reason that the muon is long-lived, because of the heavy W boson, yeah? So that means in order to produce it without, in order to produce long-lived particles without suppression, you need high energy to climb over that energy barrier. But then in order to see these long-lived signals, which by their lifetime are inherently rare, you need high intensity. You need to produce lots. So you really need both of these things. And the LHC is the only game in town for many of these kinds of theories, anything above a few GeV. Finally, so this, again, this is pragmatic and no surprise. The top-down theoretical motivation in pieces is also no surprise. We've known for a long time that all kinds of long-lived particles show up in all kinds of BSN theories. RPV-SUSY are sort of canonical examples, right-handed neutrinos. One of the things that we, oops, that's an old slide. Let me just fix, why not? That's fine, too. This works at this workshop, too. The point is that, yes, several talks today. Very good. But the point is that one of the points that we wanted to make in the white paper was to sort of make this argument by sheer weight of quantity, yeah, where we go through all the various top-down theory scenarios that are motivated for a bunch of really fundamental reasons: hierarchy problem, dark matter, barogenesis, neutrino masses. There's more. This is just sort of the thing that a limited number of people could think of, and know people that knew things that could write things for us. So, I mean, I feel like this guy when I make this diagram. It was a tough summary to write, let me tell you, yeah, when you have sort of 200 pages of this business and you want to, yes, long-lived particles, indeed. But the point is, there's a very crude sort of flow chart, and the basic, the sort of insanity of this plot conveys the message, which is that no matter what your religion, BSN, in terms of BSN physics, long-lived particles pop up everywhere and you should care about them, yeah? Okay, let's get rid of him. So, yeah, I moved to Canada for a reason. It's quite nice up there. Let's go. So, I'm just going to flash these really briefly because I'm coming back to these. But in the white paper, one of the things that we tried to do is we tried to sort of summarize in a top-down way the various BSM scenarios that we examine in a sort of two-sentence moral. Why do you have long-lived particles? Why are they at this lifetime frontier, at this very long lifetime? And how good is Methuselah? But I'll return to that once I actually tell you what an earth Methuselah is. The point is that the importance of long-lived particles in BSM theory is incredibly broad and incredibly fundamental. So we'll come back to that in a bit more detail. Okay, good. So by way of introduction, let's talk a bit about the Methuselah detector. Methuselah stands for Massive Timing Hodoscope for Ultra-Stable Neutral Particles, and we're getting a bit laborious at the end. And it's a really simple idea. It's an empty box on the surface, an external long-lived particle detector for the Hylomi LHC that searches for long-lived particles by reconstructing displaced vertices inside an air-filled decay volume. And, you know, the sort of relevant size scale is units of aircraft hangars. Yeah? That's how much you need. And it's very, very simple. It's just trackers. The original proposal, and I'm going to continue discussing it in those terms, has scintillators surrounding the detector, but there's kind of no reason to not make all this the same technology. You can have a tracking system in the roof and then a single tracking layer as a skin. So very, very simple. And it's sort of the basic logic here is that by being on the surface, you are removed from the sort of nuclear chaos that is constantly inside. And the analogy that I enjoy is, you know, there's a very important historical analogy, which is that neutrinos, you know, were hypothesized to solve a specific problem, which was lack of energy momentum conservation in beta decay. Yeah, and back then, an invisible particle was insane enough that violation of energy conservation was respectably considered. Yeah, but okay, fine. So then we spent 20 years thinking that neutrinos existed, but we had no way of detecting them because high flux sources were not available. Neutrinos are easy to make in the decay of individual atoms, but detecting any one of them is super unlikely, so you need boondoggles of them. And the only way to get that is to have a nuclear reactor, which we started having in the 50s. And then when they built these detectors, they had the incredible foresight to not put the detector inside the reactor core. That would be really complicated. Yeah. Talk about nuclear backgrounds, right? We heard that this morning. So that would be really complicated and terrifying. So by the same token, we can take a lesson from a history book. And if you think of the LHC as the nuclear reactor that for the first time ever gives us access to high fluxes of these long-lived particles, and their decay is very rare because the lifetime is very long, yeah, then you need a low background environment to observe them in, and observing them inside the production point is needlessly dangerous, yeah, and needlessly cluttered. So this tracker, it's a big box, sort of order 200 by 200 meters, and I'll get back to why that's not completely crazy. And it has a tracking system in the roof that can reconstruct that reconstructs displaced vertices. And the important thing about this reconstruction is because the detector is so huge, even totally not cutting-edge trackers will give you four-dimensional displaced vertices, where you see the charged particles in time popping their way through each layer, and the displaced vertex is a four-dimensional object. So it's much, much, much tighter constrained than just two lines intersecting. Yeah? And as a result, and this is incredibly tight, especially if you have decaying into jets, because then you have 10 charged tracks, for each of which you kind of have them in space, like a slow movie, and you can run it backwards, and they all have to meet at this point in time and space. That's incredibly important because while removing ourselves from the detector removes most of these horrible QCD backgrounds via 100 meters of rock shielding, there is, of course, activity at the surface, muons from the LHC, a little bit of elastic scattering, some neutrinos from the LHC, cosmic rays, absolute trillions of cosmic rays, and scattering atmospheric neutrinos, which are genuinely, naively speaking, irreducible background. The sort of magic of this idea, because even though it's so simple, is that the highly sort of constrained four-dimensional displaced vertex reconstruction rejects all of these things so that we claim we can search for these things with near zero background. Now that's it, yeah.
I know you're jumping ahead, but are you expecting to see any scattering neutron
events? Yeah, about 100 a year. Okay. So about 100 a year.
Not the atmospheric ones, but actually from the LHC.
Four a year. Yeah. But we can reject them. So this is a part of the talk that I just want to flash up to make sure that you're aware it exists. I will not go into detail, but when I say zero background at this thing, there's a lot of people who are justifiably skeptical. The zeroth order reason why you can do it is because you're looking for a high energy physics event. You know, think of a 20 GeV long-lived particle decaying into jets on the surface, where there are no such things. Yeah. Now, there are things like cosmic rays, but they all look hugely different that you can reject them. So the signal reconstruction is incredibly detailed in terms of the geometrical and timing requirements, various vetoes on the outside skin. You need to have fully consistent time trajectories. That gets incredibly restrictive once you have a hadronic decay, which is the one that is most motivated for Methuselah, because that's the one that the main detectors have the most struggle with. You compare that to backgrounds. The simplest background rejection is the fact that cosmic rays travel down. Very naive estimates, which are obviously optimistic, for the rejection of a single cosmic ray particle going up versus down, is 10 to the minus 15, which is enough to get rid of all the cosmic rays. Now, that is not the whole story, because you have non-Gaussian tails. But so if you really care about this, you can read this. The point is, we have a variety of reasonably robust arguments, I think, that... I'm not flashing it up to... You're not supposed to read it. This is there for the people that yell at me in every talk about zero backgrounds. You're not the audience. There's people that yell at me in every talk about about the zero background claim. So I'm happy to come back to this. And you're welcome to read this offline. But the basic story is that for each of these backgrounds, there's fairly detailed arguments for why you can reject them with very high fidelity, much higher than you need. Same for muons that come from the LHC, where they either don't give you a displaced vertex, or they give you an incredibly rare displaced vertex that is vetoable and looks different from along with particle displaced vertex due to odd particle multiplicity. And there's also some scatters that are vetoable. And finally, neutrino scattering off the air can be calculated even without simulation at the sort of 10% level quite precisely using available neutrino flux data and data on cross sections. Again, listen to my voice, don't look at the crazy writing. The point is that most neutrino scatters give you a non-relativistic proton in the final state that you can actually veto with the timing of the tracker. Even though the tracker is so primitive and relatively speaking low resolution compared to what you're used to at CMS, everything is so large, yeah, that charged particles at the speed of light need 4 nanoseconds to cross tracking layers. Yeah? So yeah.
A bit out of your peripheral vision. I just want to ask about the 100-meter sort of offset. Is that to reduce backgrounds, or is there another reason?
It's because there's a building right above.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. And also, you don't want to be right on the shaft, because that we do want the rock shielding.
I see.
So the rock shielding is super nice.
Okay.
But a priori, but it doesn't. So, it, you know, because you're 100 meters removed vertically, sort of anyway, you're limited in how much sky you can cover with this thing.
Yeah.
So if you're 50 meters away or 200 meters away, it almost doesn't matter. Like 30% difference doesn't huge difference.
Does stuff come up the shaft?
Yeah, sure. I mean,
do people go down the shaft?
No, I mean, not while it's running.
Okay.
Particles do, right?
It only has a few meters of concrete.
Ah. Yeah. So compared to the 100 meters of granite, it's very, very different.
If you're taking off from Geneva, you pass over the shaft?
Anyway, so that's a very rude question. But finally, neutrino scatters coming from the LHC can also be vetoed because of this non-relativistic proton cut. So again, let me just skip over this. I wanted to flash this by you just so that when I say zero background, I wanted to show you that there's actually quite a bit of work that went into that statement. But now let's go back to the main story. Assuming that you believe these words and these calculations, if there's zero background, then you can search for long-lived particles with a sensitivity that is essentially inversely proportional to the area of a detector. If you have a fixed height, you know, it just scales with the volume. That makes the design incredibly flexible. The fact that it's zero background and scales just with area means you give me X amount of money and I will give you 1 over X the sensitivity to long-lived particle production. Yeah, almost completely model independently. The final design will be modular and it will be deployed sort of incrementally, which means you get really good limits right away and then you ramp up quickly. The fact that it's modular means that you have a lot of freedom in maybe upgrading a few modules, so you could have high resolution for very low mass searches or some extra material for photon searches. So it's a very, very flexible idea. We would like 200 by 200 meters, but we'll take 100 by 100 if we have to. You know, we'll still be able to do most of what we want to do.
But this is going to cost you some geometric coverage for things decaying through the sides of the building.
Yeah, edge effects. Yeah. But as long as we don't go too small, it shouldn't matter. It should still be pretty proportional. Yeah. Also, if we do start being small, covering the surface with tracking layers is also not that expensive. So the outside wall. So it's sort of roughly is just volume.
Yeah, for the Mesmer case, we found this is very important. Because like the boost is not high enough, and you very often go through a wall.
the boost is not high enough.
If you have compromised all the BDK or something like that.
Oh, yeah, for the slow, that's right. So if that's right. So if you have a, if you do go down to sort of, so that's right. So Methuselah is still a fairly flat plane. If you do start approaching the sort of cube volume shape, then you have to cover all areas to make, to keep up that scaling.
Right, but that's roughly the size of Codex almost, right?
No, this is one module. Exactly. But that, sorry. So, okay, good, sorry. So they're close, but they're close enough to help each other. So the point is you can make the modules and put them in a chessboard pattern, and then the edge effects are gone. So, yeah, anyway. Anyway, so these are small details, but yeah. All of this technology is super simple. It's just trackers, RPCs, maybe simulators. And the parasitic nature of this means that it could function without modification for the high-energy LHC on the surface. Yeah, we're not messing with anything on the ground. We're just sitting on the surface. You just plug us into a new beam clock, and we're good to go. So this is actually, I think, a big advantage that will lead to the longevity of this idea. The cost estimates on the $50 million range, give or take, I would say, sort of 30%. We're converging on a more precise number. The letter of intent will be out in August this year. And CERN actually has empty land near CMS of approximately the correct size. I'm not sure if it's quite enough, but it's close enough to be on the same scale. So the whole story is not actually that insane as the size of it might initially suggest.
Do you know the names of all the people who live in those houses?
We will have to
engage with the spirit of bonhomie with these people, but the point is that this is a piece of empty land that CERN already owns. So modulo height restrictions on construction, and it should be okay. Flexible. We have an experimental collaboration that is very fun and very active, but still is very people power limited. So if there are any experimentalists in the room who want their students to actually solder something at the LHC, please get in touch with us. They'll put a soldering iron in your hand and put you to work. And we're running a test stand right now. I started taking data last week for the second time. It took 3 days of data at above the Atlas Instrument Hall last year. Then we shut down, and now it's taking data again. It's sort of 3 by 3 by 6 meters, and it's essentially a sort of mini version of Methuselah using recycled components that we scavenged from the Argo Cosmic Ray Experiment and the D0 muon system at Fermilab. So this detector costs very little money, which is great, and it's going to sort of tell us whether it's going to verify both Monte Carlo and our background rejection strategies. So this is taking data now. So that's the sort of experimental upshot, yeah? You have you and the various steps that we're taking towards trying to realize this. So now let's loop back.
So
there's two layers of the green is scintillator, and then there's three layers of RPCs.
Okay.
So meter and a bit. So actually, we might do a toy long width particle search in this thing. I think we'd be sensitive to like a 200 GeV Gluino decaying to like long width binos or something. But you know, the point is that you can a heroic displaced vertex reconstruction using two tracking layers. But anyway, just as a proof of principle. But the point is, this is both an institution building exercise as well as something that allows us to get our software pipeline up and running and all that kind of business. Yeah. Okay, so let's loop back to the long-lived particle physics. There's a really simple mnemonic to think about what on earth Methuselah does. Yeah, because Methuselah operates without backgrounds and the signal is geometrical. So there's very little thought you have to put into how to evaluate various kinds of models. Essentially, at very long lifetimes, Methuselah has about the same geometric acceptance in the long lifetime limit as for decays as Atlas or CMS. And that's really simple to understand. The sort of sensitive depth of Atlas or CMS is order a meter, but the acceptance is 4 pi. The sensitive depth of Methuselah is order 20 meters, but the geometric solid angle is about a 20th of the full thing. So there you go. So for very, very long lifetimes, where your decay, if your decay has a lifetime of 10 kilometers, then you have as much chance of decaying in the first meter as in the 100th meter. Yeah, so it's a decaying exponential. So it has the same acceptance as Atlas or CMS. You sacrifice sensitivity for short lifetimes because you're far away and you're shielded, but you gain freedom from background or trigger issues. So that's the simple, simple way to think about it. So that makes it very easy to estimate sensitivity. It's just the number of long-lived particles you see at Methuselah is approximately the number of long-lived particles you make at the LHC times a decay probability, which is essentially a sort of solid angle coverage of 1/20th times a sort of characteristic depth that you go through at an angle 30 meters divided by the lifetime. Very, very simple. That's all. That's approximately all there is to it. We studied various kinds of simplified models to study these simplifications and just to show that they're robust. So this works approximately everywhere.
Sorry, what does B bar mean?
Average boost.
Okay.
Yeah, average. So this is the sort of lab frame lifetime. So that means there's a cartoon of the cross-section reach that applies approximately everywhere. And essentially, for a lifetime of 100 meters, you probe a femtobarn. And for a lifetime of at the BBN limit of 10 to the 7 meters, you probe roughly 10 picobarns, which is a completely achievable cross-section for many purposes and means you can cap the ceiling of monolith particle parameter space in lifetime, which is kind of amazing. Yeah, like. Cosmology provides you with this one clue as to what the lifetime can be. If you can make a long enough particle at the LHC, then it's in thermal equilibrium in the early universe, and that means it was produced, and if it decays and messes up BBN, it's game over. So with a few exceptions that are a little bit strange, the sort of 0.1 second lifetime limit applies due to the N over P ratio and how sensitive everything else is to that.
Sorry. I mean, of course, the universe could have never gotten by 5
MeV. Modulo cosmology, absolutely. No, of course. But that's true of any dark matter search. Like whenever you try and connect cosmology in any way to the LHC with the cosmology assumption.
So is there missing energy in CMS when this happens?
Sort of. I'll have a slide on that.
I mean, there must be, of course.
No, there is.
Yeah, okay.
So the short answer is yes, but missing energy is a good tool if you either have a lot of it, if you either have a lot of missing energy or a moderate amount of missing energy, but lots of events that do that. You know, it's not a completely noise-free handle. Like there's a sort of noise level of missing energy.
Is there any conditioning of those processes that you list with passing a missing energy? Requirement that you not have seen missing energy in the other data?
I have a quantitative slide on that a couple down. So let me defer that a bit later.
All right, yeah.
So that's the kind of reach that applies roughly everywhere. The average boost is given by the scale of the parent process. So for sort of B hadron decay, it's as if you produce it in the 14 GeV parent decay due to the B boost. If you have a Higgs decay, it's roughly Higgs mass, and so on. So it's all sort of very simple order one, follow your nose. There's some example cross-sections that you can turn this into a mass reach. The lesson here is that a femtobarn of cross-section will give you reach if the lifetime is in this window. Yes, and the more cross-section they have, the more of a lifetime window you probe. And, femtobarn for various kind of processes, a sort of Z prime can be several TeV, gluinos can be 2 TeV, even humble binos can be 1 TeV. So you're probing TeV plus scale physics at something like Methuselah for a large range of lifetimes. Okay. There's a few interesting things that one can think of in terms of the low mass regime. Methuselah being as big as it is, and it being in your mind maybe kind of crude, it's a crude tracker, but it's not that crude. It has centimeter resolution. Yeah, that's fairly simple, but not that crude. And because it's so big, a centimeter buys you a really fine lever arm. Yeah, so the spatial resolution of the trackers is the most important bottleneck to give you a feeling for how light along the particle you can probe. And essentially, because the opening angle of these things of the along the particle decay products goes as 1 over the boost. You can probe maximum boosts, you can resolve maximum boosts as a multi-pronged displaced vertex up to a boost of around 1,000. Yeah. Now, that's crucial because if the boost is higher, the displaced vertex will merge, and you can still see it, but then the backgrounds are going to be higher than what we've computed because our background estimates are crucially relying on this geometric requirement of the displaced vertex, this full reconstruction, and they are robust down to those high boosts, but then you start losing. Yeah, there's one-pronged processes like neutrinos undergoing a neutral current interaction. Yeah, that can give you a single charge particle. So that's when things get a bit more complicated. So this is sort of, let's keep it simple and stay below that boost. That gives you a sort of minimum along the particle mass that can be probed without background, depending on the sort of parent mass scale, which translates to surprisingly low, about 10 MeV for long wave particles produced in beta case. Yeah, so that's really quite low. And for weak scale processes, sort of above 0.1 to 1 GeV. So you can really get down to very low masses. And of course, these low mass scales are, for long wave particles, almost impossible at the LHC with some exceptions. Triggering is so hard, reconstruction is so hard, upsilon backgrounds are so hard. So being able to probe the low mass regime is really exciting, and sort of puts us on an interesting on an interesting course with other experiments like SHIP. Yeah?
Just wondering, that's a neutrino with a charge current interaction, or is it actually neutral current?
I must have meant neutral current, yes, sorry.
No, I did say
neutral current. The point is, you might have a neutrino just knocking a proton out of a nucleus, and then you have a one-pronged displaced vertex.
Oh, the proton.
But the point is, if your displaced vertices are merged, that's a background. Yeah. Because Methuselah is only a tracker, no calorimetry, no magnetic fields, but the geometry, now, by the very same principle, the geometry of the displaced vertex actually tells you the boost, event by event, and that's based on the simple assumption that in most scenarios we'd consider, and this is not perfect, but that's a problem, the various imperfections in this are bridged across once we are lucky enough to have a signal rich enough to study. But in principle, most Langlois particles that we consider are going to be heavier than the decay products, whatever they may be, whether it's a QCD decay products, in which case they give rise to quote-unquote thermal pions, so everything's kind of nice and isotropic, or if it decays to leptons, you have very light leptons in the final state, you can neglect the masses of the final state particles, and the tracker, and in that case, you can do a Lorentz transformation on these tracks backwards until they're spherically symmetric, and you recover the boost event by event with surprising event by event accuracy. You can use that with some information from the main detector to diagnose the production mode. The multiplicity tells you the decay mode. You might even put some material in there to detect photons. And you can relate the boost to the Langlois particle mass. So all that's a very detailed story that depends a lot on how you can interface with the main detector, and it's sort of one of those bridges to cross on some level once you find something, but it's really cool to know that there's a lot of detailed physics you can do once you find a Langlois particle, even with just a big tracker. Okay, good. So, having told you how sensitive Methuselah is in sort of absolute sense, before anyone gives us $50 million or something in that size scale, we have to show that we're actually better than the main detectors.
Sorry, really quick before you go on. Okay. So, it doesn't matter if there's invisible stuff that's produced in the decay also, right?
It'll probably reduce the sort of event-by-event fidelity of these exercises, but on average it'll still work.
Because you can still reconstruct the pointing for the thing if you do so.
Oh, sorry, for background reduction, no, that doesn't matter. Yeah.
No, sorry. You're sensitive to signals where you can have a partially visible decay.
That's right, as long as you have at least two prongs.
Good, okay.
Yeah. I mean, some of this stuff will change depending on what assumptions you make if there's big invisible particles, but yeah. Good. So how do we fare compared to the main detectors? Well, there's this one study that we did in the original paper. Obviously, main detectors are better at short lifetimes. That's just a given. That's not our ball game. So let's focus on long lifetimes, bigger than order 100 meters or so. The nice thing is that Methuselah can look for a single Langlois particle, of course. So that means the corresponding search at the main detector should also look for only a single Langlois particle. As soon as you require two, your sensitivity scales with lifetime squared and you're toast at long lifetimes. Yeah? So there's one benchmark we studied originally, which was exotic Higgs decays, Langlois particles that decays mostly hadronically. And in that case, there is a reasonably robust study that we did earlier for the reach of a hypothetical search in the Atlas Neuron System for a single Langlois particle, which suffers from a knowable amount of QCD background, knowable because it's in the data. And then the public data that we could just read of the experimental paper. So the end result was that Methuselah wins compared to the best case main detector projection for the Hailumi LHC, both in lifetime and cross-section, or branching ratio as it may be, by a factor of 1,000. Yeah, a factor of 1,000 sensitivity gain. And we thought that was pretty phenomenal. And the question is, how does this phenomenal sensitivity gain transfer to other Langlois particle signals? So now I'm going to loop back to the lifetime frontier at the main detector. How do we talk about Langlois particles at the main detectors? And the answer is that we have to try and understand the space of signals, and and the way that we do this is, of course, dictated by how we have to do the searches. And the main bottleneck is background and triggering. Yeah? Like if you have 50 GeV muons, life is excellent. If you have 200 GeV jets, life is excellent, or 400 GeV of MET. Yeah? But if the only thing that's going on is that a bunch of particles converge in space away from the interaction point, while that is incredibly spectacular and gives you very, very low backgrounds, it's also complicated and weird enough that it's very difficult to trigger on directly at level 1, which is a really important limitation at the LHC. If you can't trigger at level 1 and you can't record the event, no matter how spectacular the signal is, you have no luck. So the backgrounds are smaller, but they're difficult to calculate, and triggering is difficult. So in all of these cases, we do sort of displaced vertex plus X search, where X can be anything else that helps you reduce background and or trigger. So if you have a displaced vertex that along with particle that decays to relatively hard leptons, you can trigger on those leptons. The leptons reduce background. You have no background at the LHC. Life is good. Same with hard jets. But not so for other cases. So finding the physics case for Methuselah, which has the same geometrical acceptance for long particle decays in the very long lifetime limit as Atlas or CMS, translates to understanding what long-lived particle searches or signals in general the main detectors are not good at. Because that's the gaps that Methuselah can fill. Yeah? So, and I said, background and trigger. At level one, you can't trigger on anything except in the Atlas muon system.
So how does Urey's track trigger?
So Urey's track trigger at level one requires two long-lived particles. Because if you require one long-lived particle and nothing else, the background level is still so high that you totally overwhelm your trigger. So, yeah, that's a really important point, because being able to trigger on a single long-lived particle level one would be phenomenal, but then you're kind of running into irreducible backgrounds, the QCD chaos. Yeah. Whereas in the Atlas muon system, you can trigger on a single long-lived particle because you're shielded by the HKL from the QCD chaos, so the trigger rate is reasonable, and the fact that the HKL does not light up versus the MS lighting up is a really simple sort of, you know, like it's a scalar trigger, it's just a single number as opposed to some crazy vertex. Anyway, so the strategy for understanding the LHC signal space is going to be taking a lesson, and this is something that's appearing in the white paper on the LHC side soon, is that you want to take advantage of the spectacular nature of the long-lived particle decay, both its decay or its visible propagation if it's not neutral. And because the geometrical nature of this long-lived particle is so spectacular, the precise kinematics are not that important. You don't have to separate whether something is spin 1/2 or spin 0. It doesn't really matter all that much. The mere fact that it's displaced and gives you hard jets or not is what will tell you how well you can probe it. So basically, in finding a simplified model basis of long-lived particles, you just need to characterize the character, and so jets or leptons or whatever, and the approximate energy range in sort of rough chunks, kind of qualitatively, of both the prompt objects produced with the long-lived particle, which can help with triggering and background reduction, or ditto for the decay products. So that leads you to sort of write down these simplified models for long-lived particles, where you consider production and decay mode separately, because you sort of consider them in a totally factorized fashion, and to sort of span the range of searches and things that you might trigger on, you have basically some of the usual suspects that don't cover everything but cover most of the important things. Direct pair production, a heavy parent, something like supersymmetry, Gluino decaying to Beano, Higgs-like processes, and a heavy resonance. These are separate because this is initiated by valence quarks, this is initiated by gluons, so they have different ISR characteristics which matter for monojet searches and net-based triggers. And charge currents, which is basically code for heavy neutrinos. And then you take all these production modes and you say, my long-lived particle can decay into these things, and you fill a table, and you are left with a table that is only 70% filled. It would have been nicer if it was emptier, but physics is too interesting and multivariate. But at least it's a table that you can start crossing off, and more importantly, there are many searches that can sort of fill whole columns in certain lifetime ranges, right? So in each of these points, you have a certain production mode, a certain decay mode, and then there's a parameter space in here of lifetime and mass and maybe another thing. But many searches will cover many of these things for certain masses or lifetimes. So you can start organizing this crazy signature space that we've been sort of blindly poking at for the last few years, and hopefully over the next 5 years, develop a sort of systematic long-lived particle search program at the LHC. Yeah?
This table, the crosses on those, searches that currently don't exist?
Or no, so the crosses are searches, the crosses were originally blank, but that turned out to be too undiplomatic. But the crosses are just saying, the crosses have a footnote attached to them which say, we're not saying there are no physics models in these boxes, but we would say that the most minimal models prefer to be away from these boxes. So really,
it's a model statement, not a statement of the searches.
That's right. Okay. That's right. So the point of this table is, experimentalists, if you want to work on this stuff, think about your search or your trigger or your detector or your system. You can kind of cover this, and maybe you need to focus on this stuff before you focus on that stuff. It's just meant to provide a roadmap, a little bit of theory bias to start a way forward. Because right now, we have this inverse Swiss cheese problem. We're not filling gaps. We're just starting to fill a space that is completely uncovered. Yeah. So inverse Swiss cheese, exactly. So How do we now that we have a sort of qualitative understanding of Atlas and of the Atlas and CMS signals, how do we compare that to Methuselah? Well, quantifying the main detector along the particle signal is very easy at the order one level. It's just geometry and cross sections, the usual simple thing. Yeah, same as Methuselah essentially. How many events do I have? The big problem is that searches with single long length particles at the main detectors often have some backgrounds, and it's difficult to quantify those backgrounds because there isn't enough high luminal HC studies yet. So it's very difficult to make quantitative comparisons, but we can still extract some very general intuition that's very useful from the existing examples. So that's what we're going to try and do now and parameterize. For something like Methuselah, and I'm reasonably certain that this would transfer with minimum modification to, with some quantitative modifications, obviously, as we'll see, but this idea of comparing along with particle reach, I think, applies to most external detectors, including codecs and phaser. You can define the long lifetime sensitivity gain at Methuselah, where you stick to the very long lifetime limit, and in that limit, in that regime, the cross-section limit that you can achieve at the main detector versus Methuselah, the ratio does not depend on the lifetime, yeah, because everything just has a very low chance of decaying everywhere, and everything's linear.
Yep. Are missing energy studies in the numerator?
I'm gonna address those in a couple of slides. I'm doing just long with particle searches right now.
Okay, so you have to detect within the detector.
That's right, exactly. So these are long with particle searches where I'm relying on seeing one of the long with particles decay in macroscopic distance.
That's called Hertzian experiments, right? You produce and detect. That's what Hertz did.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
You're not the first person to go through these arguments.
Well, I mean, let me say it the other way around, right?
Yeah.
So 99.9% of searches at the LHC are Hertzian searches, where we hope to produce a gluino, the gluino promptly decays into jets, and you know.
Absolutely.
So the point is, we're sticking to that, and you're missing some things, but you're the thing that you're producing, you're observing it directly, the gluino decay or whatever.
In a sense, a
pure monojet search that make something that's new physics and it escapes as missing energy, and the only thing that you see is an unrelated initial state radiation sort of marker of the missing energy. That might be the only exception that is truly non-Hertzian by that definition. But anyway, so I'm just focusing along the.
You'll come back to that later.
The missing energy search is a couple slides away. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm just dividing the discussion into long with particle searches and missing energy searches.
And common on this cut depends on the experiment that you're looking at, right? The lifetime cut.
Oh, yeah, totally. Exactly. So wherever...
Especially for phaser, this is much shorter.
That's right. So wherever you enter that regime, and from that regime onwards... Exactly. So where the cutoff is also important information, but that's where you kind of transfer to the other detector obviously being better, right? So for lifetimes much less than this, say 1 meter, the other detector is obviously better, yeah? And then there's some transition regime. Absolutely. So that number is also part of the definition, in a sense. Yeah. Very good. So can we estimate this for kind of characteristically different LH along with particle signals? So here's the approach. You imagine in your mind a certain high Lumi LHC long length particle search. You look for a displaced vertex in the tracker in association with a high energy jet, HT more than 400, GV, or something. Whatever it is, yeah? Insert your favorite search. You compare the main detector search for that single X decay to the Methuselah search for that same long length particle X. And your Halumi search has a set of geometrical requirements on where the long-length particle can decay, the tracker, the muon system, whatever it is, as well as some non-geometrical trigger and cut requirements. Yeah. So, for example, you might require to produce it in association with a Z boson that decays leptonically, or you might require it to be associated together with a jet that has an energy more than something. Yeah. So you can break down what this ratio is, and it looks kind of complicated. It's just parameterizing ignorance in various layers the best that we can, but I'm going to justify why this makes a bit of sense later. Essentially, this purple thing is the ratio of geometric acceptances, which, depending on the main detector subsystem, is sort of 1. So it doesn't really matter that much. Yeah. This is the ratio of reconstruction efficiencies at Methuselah versus the LHC. Methuselah tends to have a higher one because it has to worry about less things. But that maybe is 2 or so. It's 2 to 5 or 10. Doesn't matter that much. The important thing are these two numbers. The LHC cut efficiency is essentially the amount of signal the LHC loses due to its non-geometrical requirements. Yeah, whether it's a particular branching ratio because it needs a clean leptonic decay, or whether it's that you need a jet more than 300 JeV or something. Yeah, and that's something that you can compute on your signal using just sort of MagRef simulations. Yeah, or whatever you know about the theory. And if your Hi-Lemy LHC search is background free, then Methuselah will be more sensitive by this factor of 1 over the cuts, because simply Methuselah sees all of it, sort of, and LHC has to impose whatever cut it imposes. Yeah? If there is any background at the Hi-Lemy LHC bigger than an autobarn, you lose by an additional square root of background factor. Yeah? And we have the reason why it makes sense to parameterize it in this fashion is that you can then do a search in 3 years, figure out what the background cross-section is, plug it in here, and get the Methuselah sensitivity gain. So it was a way of parameterizing the advantage of Methuselah compared to the LHC so that once more studies are done in the future, we can kind of keep track of how we're doing. So that's why this is useful. And whenever there are backgrounds bigger than autobahn, trigger efficiency, or cut requirements that are cut into your LHC signal, Methuselah will win. But by how much? There's a few examples. Long-lived particles decaying into well-separated leptons with order 10 JeV of energy. That's a pretty golden channel. You can trigger on leptons, displace, you know, the lepton requirement plus the geometrical displaced vertex requirement means there's almost no background, and the sensitivity gain is order 1. It's not that exciting. It's probably going to be similar if the long-lived particle doesn't decay into leptons but is produced always in association with leptons, but that's kind of rarely the case. You usually have a bunch of decay channels, and if you require leptons in the final state, RS is going to be 1 over the branching ratio. So that can be 10, can be 50. Yeah. If your long-lived particle decays completely into leptons, but it has a mass of below 10 JeV, you're in the lepton jet regime, the displaced lepton jet regime, and existing studies seem to suggest that the background after cuts, just based on the hadronic zoo below 10 JeV, is in the sort of 10 femtobarn regime. And that means your sensitivity gain is sort of 10 to 100. That's getting pretty good. And then, of course, there's something that essentially is our exotic Higgs decay example. If your long-lived particle decays hadronically, so you can't use lepton triggers, and has a mass that's less than 200 JeV and is not produced in association with lots of hard jets, then you're sort of stuck with the Atlas muon system and you have 1,000 sensitivity gain. On the other hand, if you do decay hadronically but you're massive enough or high energy enough to pass HT level 1 triggers, then again you're stuck, and LHC does just fine. This is, of course, good for the LHC. But this kind of tells you where Methuselah will win. Methuselah will win for sort of weak scale and below hadronic stuff, and 10 JeV and below leptonic stuff. And that's a huge space of target models that we can't look for at the LHC at the sensitivity right now. There's a really interesting paper that came out a couple of weeks ago, and this is one of those things that the long-lived particle community has been thinking about how much we could gain by thinking about timing cuts at the main detector. So I've hopped on about Methuselah making so much money off the fact that it's so big and you can reconstruct the displaced vertex in full 4D, so to speak, and that rejects a lot of backgrounds. Now, full four-dimensional tracking is out of the reach for the LHC or the Hi-Lemy LHC, but adding a single timing layer, a single layer of material that has some coarse spatial resolution, but picosecond timing resolution, is one of the proposed CMS upgrades, just on the inside of the eCal. And it makes a lot of sense to ask, how much do you gain by using this timing signal? If you have a long-lived particle that might be quite slow, and it decays, and its decay product takes this triangular path to the timing layer, then then you're going to have a delay compared to a jet or whatever that goes directly through. But this time delay goes as 1 over boost squared, yeah, because the opening angle goes as inverse boost, and the time traveled goes as inverse boost. Yeah. But this can be quite sizable. If you have a timing layer of order a meter size, you get nanosecond type delays, or even 0.1 nanosecond type delays for order 1 boosts. And I find it surprising myself that you can get reasonably relativistic particles with boosts of 5 and still have detectable time delay. So that's a potentially incredibly powerful technique. This paper by Zhen and by Liu Squid and Lian Tao, They consider Higgs decays and Higgs-Eno signals, but let me talk about Higgs decays because we've already discussed that example. They consider two kinds of searches, and I'm kind of indicating what I like about them and what I'm a little bit skeptical about. There's the 30 picosecond timing layer on the inside of the CMS eCal, which is nice because it's similar to proposed upgrades, so that's pretty realistic. But their search strategy is you want to search for Higgs's decaying to a single long of particles. You see one long of particle, and you require only a single 30 GeV ISR jet. And that's your entire event requirement. So if you're looking for this decay in the CMS inside the tracker, essentially, it is a mystery to me how you would trigger at level one. And that's a difficulty. You know, I've communicated with these authors. These are friends of ours, you know, and you know, they acknowledge this, but it's something that might be possible, but it sounds very challenging because you'd essentially need full four-dimensional vertex reconstruction for both the ISR jet that sets the beginning of the timing and the displaced vertex, which sets the end of the timing at level one. So that's very tough. They then claim to get to zero background by walking out 26 timing resolutions to reduce the hard jet fake background, and non-Gaussian tails mean that should not be taken too quantitatively seriously, I think. Similarly, they propose, well, triggering is hard here, but triggering is great in the Atlas muon system, so let's build a 30 picosecond timing layer on the outside of the Atlas muon spectrometer. That would be totally awesome, but is, I think, out of scope, but it's cool to consider, especially because maybe we'll do it for the future collider. But if you could have this timing layer at the 10-meter radius, you'd have to do a much less aggressive timing cut and to reduce your much smaller background, only 7-time resolutions. Now, if background-free, each of these two searches comes within 1/10 of Methuselah sensitivity at long lifetimes, which is super cool. Well, it's super cool for physics. But the truth is that I don't think that reach is realistic because of the trigger issues and also because the backgrounds that they consider are only the ones that can be reduced by this timing. They don't consider other backgrounds that will dominate, like material interactions or beam halo, which will give you these flat time distributions. But regardless of these details, timing will definitely improve the main detector significantly by
so
our...
The suggestion is basically not to build Methuselah, but a CMS detector.
We don't eat each other. Like we want to build every and all such things. Of course, when I read this paper, I tried very hard to understand how robust this claim is, so that I knew whether to stop working on Methuselah or not. And I'm not stopping to work on Methuselah. But I am 100% saying that we should use these timing layers, because they will help a lot. I don't think they will help to reduce background by 7 orders of magnitude, but I think they will help a lot. Okay. What about missing energy searches? Okay, so we've had Philip Harris do some really nice studies for us, kind of in the scope of these CMS monojet analyses, and these very nice, and essentially, the MET searches are great if your long of particle production cross-section is sizable. Oh, I need to finish soon. Sorry. If the MET searches are great if the long of particle production cross-section is sizable and your MET is high, a few hundred GeV. If either of those two is not true, so if your MET is only 200 GeV or if your production is not so big, then, you know, MET is a noisy filter. It's not that perfect. So if you look at some of these dark matter models where you pretend that the dark matter has a lifetime, then this is the reach for the monojet search, and this is the reach from Methuselah for different kinds of lifetimes. And for supersymmetry, like a Gluino or a Squark, we fill in the entire sort of even moderately compressed region up here. So MET searches and long particle searches are totally complementary. The MET search will have a larger mass reach depending on the lifetime. But of course, even if you see a MET signal, you want to answer the cosmologically relevant question of whether you have produced a dark matter candidate or whether you have produced some unstable state that has nothing to do with the cosmology of the universe. So that's a really important question. Okay, so I've gone into this already. The point is that Methuselah can gain many orders of magnitude, and we sort of have a qualitative understanding of how many orders of magnitude, and it'll complement MET searches and provide a different discovery channel. So, and all of these results are recyclable. So let me flash through very quickly. I'm sorry. We've had a fun discussion. I'm going to take a few more minutes just to flash this really quickly. We define a fun acronym in the white paper called McPhoto. Methuselah could be the first only discovery opportunity. We're thinking of having like a dog label or something. You can divide in order to provide some semblance of some semblance of synthesis and overview over this forest of top-down models, we tried to split the discussion, apart from showing this crazy flowchart that I showed you before, we tried to split the discussion into two groups. Scenarios where the long-lived particle is strongly motivated as an intrinsic part of the theory, where it does a job that's intrinsic to the theory itself, Or the ascent scenarios where the long lived particles are just part of this theory in parameter space and you just need to look for it to have full coverage. Yeah. So I don't think one is more motivated than the other. But in this case, the long lived particle has more teeth in the theory mechanism. So on the intrinsic side, we have things like neutral naturalness, where the long lived particle existence comes from the fact that you have to have a hidden sector, which is related to the standard model by a discrete symmetry. This is the kind of plot I've shown many times before, a parameter space of the hidden hadron mass in the hidden sector versus the top partner. And the point is Methuselah fills in this low mass plane, and it's the only one that does. And this is a region of mass space that is, with a big tilde sign, motivated more in things like in fraternal Higgs theories, because their sort of Z2 arguments would push you towards the lower hadron mass range. You can also look for the long-lived neutrinos in the sort of different cosmological flavor of these models. You can look for WIMP baryogenesis, where you produce baryons in the lifetime decay of a sort of WIMP-like parent in a variety of models, and the lifetime has to be fairly long, so that's a case where the long-lived particle both does an important job, and you're pushing the long lifetime regime. Various flavors of auxenos or higgsenos decaying to auxenos show up in something like FIMPDOC matter, where you produce it via freeze-in, or various flavors of supersymmetry. In all these cases, you can probe these really nice, so in the higgseno case, you can probe Petchiquin confinement, Petchiquin breaking scales of 10 to the 15 GeV, and you can beat the LHC by anywhere between 1 and 2 orders of magnitude. RPV-SUSY, same kind of story. And this is the minimal right-handed neutrino model. I just want to point out that we are almost competitive with SHIP at these sort of few GV. It's a terrible plot in the sense that I cut off the axis, that's why. But this is sort of 1 to 10 GeV here. And the point is that Methuselah and SHIP are very close, even at low masses, and at high masses we even beat SHIP a little bit because we have better sensitivity at long lifetimes. So this is a super exciting plot because it means that we can be part of the big boy conversation where SHIP is asking for $250 million and we ask for a fifth. So that's fun. It's also dangerous. Anyway, so then there's the generic models, hidden valleys, standard model plus singlets. Again, we do nicely with SHIP, and I think as Simon will talk about, there's a sort of dream team configuration where all the models that SHIP probes, Methuselah plus Phaser plus Codex can sort of cover that space quite nicely. Methuselah plus Codex plus Phaser plus Sequest for the dark photon. So it's an interesting sort of triangulation there. Standard model plus vector, dark photon models, you can probe them in various ways. So there you go. I'm not going to go into detail here, but Methuselah is a great cosmic ray telescope, which is super cool to have a guaranteed physics return and a secondary physics objective. There's a lot that I can tell you all about this offline, but the zeroth order reason why Methuselah is a cosmic ray physics telescope is because it costs $50 million, and the cosmic ray flagship experiment Pierre Auger costs $20 million. So the scale of money is so different that something that is an LHC add-on could become the world-leading cosmic ray telescope in this energy range and address all kinds of very, very fascinating astroparticle physics questions that I'll be happy to tell you about offline. It's a busy year for us. We're finishing the white paper in a couple of weeks on the archive. The cosmic ray white paper is going to come out a few months later. The letter of intent will be finished off in a workshop in August, and we're going to be submitting our results to the PBC subgroup at the LHC, together with the other detectors to sort of see how we compare to SHIP, and then submit everything to CERN and the European strategy at the end of 2018. And we're done. Thank you. This is just the best. Come on. All right. Go, Simon. Actually, yeah. Do you want the remote? Or?
Oh,
they
have a stick, actually.
Oh, they have a stick? I would have loved the stick. Okay.
Okay. All right, so I'll tell you briefly something about two of the more smaller experiments that are sort of in a similar spirit, and I'm going to go real fast, so you can talk to me later or stop me if you have any detailed questions. So it's going to be sort of a rough overview. So the first one is a phaser proposal from the UC Irvine group from last year. And this is the one, Codex-B is what I'm involved in. And so both of these are quite a bit younger than Methuselah. So in that sense, there's also less details to talk about in the first place anyways. But they're both moving forward, and I think there's interesting things there. This you don't need anymore. Lots of longer particles are in a standard model, and they tend to get longer lived if you go lower in mass, and I think we all know why. So let me not dwell on this. This is essentially, as I understand it, the current landscape of like existing and or proposed detectors for this sort of shielded lifetime frontier. So David talked about Methuselah. We'll hear about Millikan in a bit. And so I'll just show a few slides about Phaser and then talk a bit about Codex-P. So these are all slides I stole from Jamie Boyd from last week's talk. So the idea of Phaser is, so here is the larger C-ring goes this way. This is the SPS, and this is the ATLAS interaction point. And so they observe that there is like a service tunnel here close to the CMS interaction point, which is sort of, if you follow the tangent of the ATLAS collision point, like particles going straight, we sort of hit this spot, and they're proposing to put a detector there. And because there's a lot of rock, there's some rock and some detector material, you know, accelerator material here, this also provides the type of shielding that David was talking about. So this is their tunnel that they're showing, so it actually exists, and you know it's over here is a sort of blown up version of the slide I just showed, and this is their sort of animation on what this would look like. So the one thing to keep in mind here is this is I think this is the where the particles would be coming from. It needs to be very low to the ground in order to have the right coverage. And so they need to partially bury it, and they're thinking of like a tube of like roughly 4 meters long as a decay volume. It's going to be about a meter-ish in diameter, maybe a smaller one at first. The reason why such a small detector can actually work for them is because they're looking in the extremely poor regime where the particles are looking for extremely collimated. And so provided you align this very, very carefully with the LHC beam, you have a very good geometric acceptance for very light long-lived particles. So it's different from what Methuselah is trying to do and from what Codex-B is trying to do, where we're looking for more lower eta particles that are produced in sort of higher energy, at higher energies essentially, higher center of mass. And this is the sort of rough concept of the detector. So essentially, there's an empty decay volume. There's like a scintillator veto to veto incoming beam events, essentially muons or just protons scattering off the beam. They have like a tracking system over here. I don't think they have settled on exactly how many layers they want. And at the end, there's going to be an electromagnetic colorimeter. This is one sensitivity plot. I'll show some more later with like all the experiments on it. This is for this dark photon model. So if you have a dark photon that's mixing with the standard model photon, you produce it in pion decays. And so the forward pion cross-section in their acceptance is really, really massive. And so they get a lot of these things. And so because these things are so boosted, even though they're 200 meters down the pipe, they're still sensitive to this sort of lifetimes. And this yellow region here is what they're sensitive to as compared to like the LHCb projections. And so this sort of more or less has the same sensitivity that something like Sequest can do. And there's other models along those lines that I'll talk about in a second. The main point of this talk is going to be Codex-B. And again, I'm going to be a bit short on details, but feel free to ask me whenever. So this is a drawing of the LHCb cavern, which is something I hadn't seen before until like a year ago. This is the beam axis over here. So protons come in this way and this way. They interact and they collide this blue dot. And this triangular thing over here is LHCb, the LHCb main detector. MODOL sits on this side. Then there's some empty space over here. This is the counting room, where this is a 3-meter concrete wall. This is where the electronics are, and this is the corpse of Delphi. So they just sort of shoved that aside after the LEP2, and it's an exhibit. You can go see it. I'm told it's very nice. I haven't had the fortune of actually going down. But the key point is that in the next upgrade, the next shutdown, in next year essentially, the data acquisition will move to the surface because they need more computing and it just doesn't fit anymore in here. So this is going to route a fiber optic cable to the surface, build a shed on the top, and do all the computing there. So there's some space, roughly 10 by 10 by 10 meters, that becomes available roughly 25 meters away from the interaction point. And so this is an opportunity we would want to try to use. So this is what we have in mind. So you try to instrument this volume over here, 10 by 10 by 10 meters. You get a little bit of shielding already from this concrete wall, but you're going to need more. So you have to dump like a chunk of lead in front of the interaction point, roughly of, as I'll show, like 4 meters of let will do it. And to veto muons coming in, scattering in this shield over here, creating kaons, we envision like an active muon veto built in into the shield.
What LHCb people say about it? I mean, they're fine.
We'll talk about this. Yeah. This will be an LHCb experiment.
I see.
So this will be a sub-detector of LHCb, and it will be wired into the LHCb trigger readout, and so you do event reconstruction, the whole thing together. So this is not a separate detector, a separate experiment we're proposing. We're proposing an additional detector for LHCb. So yeah, so we're not messing around in their cavern without asking, if that's what you're...
Yes, of course. of course.
How many interactions like in the lead and how many in the
This is 7 and this is about 25. It's like total adds up to like 32, I believe, if I recall correctly. And that's more or less enough. It's a factor of 3-ish more than like the Atlas colorimeter. I had a slide about that, but I cut it. We can talk about that if you want. All right, so this is sort of a rough first draft on what this kind of thing could look like. So as David mentioned for Methuselah, we're envisioning for this sort of very simple first idea to use RPC layers, where each of these red things are like a sixplet of layers, so that you have some nice redundancy in there. We want to instrument all edges, because if you have a 10 by 10 meter box and you're interested in low boost particles coming from B decays, very often these things will go down the wall, the decay products, and so if you only instrument the back over here, you're going to pay a factor of 10 in sensitivity just from that. The green layers in the middle are just to improve our vertex resolution, because the vertex resolution is dominated by the distance of the vertex to the first measured point. And so this is what helps us with that. And this will help with background rejection if there's any background still coming through the shield. So I think I said that. These are the two main points. The red is because of this, and the green is because of we want to have good vertex reconstruction because we're inside a cavern. Background, so I'm going to very quickly mention a kind of background. So you can have a neutral particle, like a hadron, coming through. Neutrons are our main background, kaelons, that kind of thing. Kaelon can decay over here, a neutron can scatter against the air, create tracks. The only way to get rid of these things is to just make sure you have enough lead. So we calculate how much lead we need. The answer is 4.5 meters. The other backgrounds that are more subtle are muons, because they don't get attenuated enough. So they go through. Maybe they make a kaelon over here. And so you need an active veto to kill these things off. If the muon... Yes?
What are the things that go around the lead shield?
Just you mean like something ricketing this way?
The LHCb detector produces a neutral that then goes through.
Yeah, so this is why we... That's another reason why you need to instrument all sides. If something comes in from this side, you want to have some sort of timing resolution on seeing where this is coming from. You can distinguish between this and this, as David was saying.
Something that just goes above that shield to the concrete.
Oh, sorry. Maybe this picture is not to scale, but like the idea is that this covers a whole solid angle, of course. You're worried about something bouncing off the cavern wall.
No, or from the rest of the detector.
From the LHCb detector. Yes, yeah. So these are things that need to be measured and simulated. We think that they're small at the moment, but like I'll tell you, we have a test stand that's going to go into the cavern behind this shield that's going to measure these things. But
you really have a rejection for those, I guess, except maybe looking for the fact that there was an event there.
Yeah, we have of course access to the actual event, right? The LHCb event.
But other than that,
yeah, we have some event reconstruction over here because of the different layers, right? So we can point back from where the vertex came from. And what you want is you want a vertex that points back to the primary interaction point. So more detailed simulations need to be done for this. This is a rather subtle problem. But we think that with sufficient tracking resolution, you should be able to address this.
So that veto is in the shield.
It's in the shield, yeah.
So yeah, these vetoes, how much of a veto efficiency can you get out of that reliably? Like, how many orders of magnitude can you suppress?
That's this right here. So we aspire to be serious people. So what we do is we have an analytic model for how these things propagate through lead and concrete, like from the PDG. But we also do the corresponding JN simulation to make sure these two things match. So you take your input of data flux calibrated from Atlas and from Pythia. You propagate it through all the shielding, and you see what comes out on the other side. And so these are the dominant particle yields that come into the box. So for neutrons or antineutrons, you have about 5 times 10 to the 4 of these things that are induced by a muon collision. So this is the answer to your question. What you need is like a veto 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. So you're going to need multiple redundant scintillator layers to do this. So single layer is not going to do it, so you need 3 or 4 layers. And then the irreducible amount of neutrons that go into the box with this amount of shielding is about 7. And so that is brings you, once you acquire it, they actually scatter against air. That puts down the background rate below 1. Should we have underestimated this, we add 0.5 meter more lead, and then you should be fine. So just to give you a sense that the amount of lead you need is of the order of meters, not of the order of 20, 30 meters for this sort of thing. There's many more things to say about backgrounds, and anyone who's interested, we can talk about it afterwards. But I think this is all I want to say during the talk. So here are some example models. There's more in the backup slides if you want. This is the model that David talked about. There's a Higgs boson decaying to 2 long-lived particles. It's sort of a standard benchmark people are using. The other one is, so if you have a light scalar mixing with a Higgs, you can produce it in through a penguin diagram in B decays. And then there's the heavy neutral leptons. That chip is also that's sort of the flagship model for SHIP. So we all started using that to compare experiments. And ALPs are in the backup slides. So this is the reach for exotic Higgs decay. So you want to look. So these shaded bands are extrapolations of what the current ATLAS search would look like at 3T inverse Aldebaran. For us, what you want to look at is a solid orange line. That's the fat orange line. These two lines are slightly different assumptions on the geometry and so on. Again, if you're interested, I can tell you about it afterwards. But really, the sort of most conservative design is these solid lines over here. And so you see we're comparable to ATLAS once these particles are about 10 GeV. And we do quite a bit better if you're very low mass. And so the point here is that unlike Methuselah, light, Encodex B is really a detector specifically for light long-lived particles. Because if you start going like 30, 40 GeV for these things, we are no longer beating ATLAS, and we don't aspire to. So our reach in that sense is more limited. This dotted line here is the curve that David showed for Methuselah. So this is roughly a factor of 100 in sensitivity. And a factor of 10 comes from the geometric acceptance, which is a factor of 10 smaller than Methuselah. And we're at LHCb, so we have a factor of 10 total luminosity less than ATLAS and CMS. And so that adds up to 100. So that sort of checks out. This is a nice, a very colorful plot of scalar mixing with the Higgs. There's a virtual top quark over here. It's a bit of one of these things. And so the blue is obviously the Codex B reach as a function of the mass of this new scalar versus the mixing angle with the Higgs. This is the LHCb reach. This is the ancient charm limit. And here are the different other experiments. We're sort of sitting in the middle of SHIP and Methuselah, and we're fairly complementary with something like Phaser. So important lesson sort of for the whole program, I think, to look at this is that Phaser actually has the shortest baseline for all of these experiments. And so they are the furthest away, but because everything is so boosted in the forward region, their effective baseline is actually shorter than Codex. And then Codex has a slightly shorter baseline than Methuselah just because we're closer. We have the same eta range. And sort of Methuselah has the longest baseline. So that's how you, in your mind, you organize where these things sit.
This is the production mechanism for BDK?
Correct. Yeah. And so one just word of caution. If you're looking at these plots, this plot, we recasted all these limits to make sure that the same theory assumptions were made. But there's different theory assumptions on the market on the lifetime of this thing. There's a lot of hadronic uncertainties in this regime. So you should always be aware that you're comparing apples with apples because this can change the reach of different experiments quite a bit. Okay, so there's another reference there. And then to finish off, just say something that we can look for neutral heavy neutral leptons. Where essentially you have a sterile neutrino, you make it through mixing with a standard model neutrino coming from B decay, charm decay, any hadronic final state. So the red is, again, our reach, which is comparable. It's a bit better than A62. It's comparable to Phaser, which is this one of these two blue lines, it's hard to see here, and Methuselah N does again with roughly the factor of 100 better, as you would expect, just from the geometric coverage and the luminosity. You can do the same thing for, this is mixing with the electron neutrino, you can do the muon and the tau and so on. They're in the backup slides, if you want to see these reach plots. They're fairly similar. Moving forward, so we're churning out more benchmark models. There's going to be a benchmark paper that should have appeared already a long time ago, but it will appear where we summarize all these things. On the LECB side, more importantly, there's like half a dozen to a dozen people working on this, and so they are one thing that has been done already. So this is a test stand that's been built that will go down into the cavern this summer to measure the muon fluxes, essentially to calibrate the simulations that we have done. We're working on different detector layouts, so like a shrink of detector is not entirely off the table. There are a lot more studies to be done to really make that decision. And then we're also preparing for a proposal for the phase two upgrade. This is the timeline. We are right now here. The data acquisition goes to the surface next 2 years. We're aiming to install the full thing during the phase three upgrade, but we may try to install a smaller version to take some physics data already during the short shutdown. But that's still pending. I think that's all I have, yes. So I'll take questions or yield the floor to my colleague from Millikan. Yeah.
Maybe I missed it. What's the price tag?
The price tag of this thing is we want to try to do this. Well, this is always very difficult to, you know, because I'm being recorded and everything. Right? But in dimensionless units, right, so the amount of tracking that we need is about 100 of David's, right? So if you divide his cost with a factor of 100, and then you add marginal cost because you need to buy, you know, your gas system, and there's electronics, there's things like that. So I think the aim is you have to try to do this under $10 million. Yeah. That's what we should be aiming for. And I think that is feasible, but, you know, it's been 8 months since we wrote this paper, so we're still working on that. That goes for, what does it go for?
I remember that's only a couple of dollars a pound. I think that's what we're talking about. If you buy it new, you want to buy it used, obviously. But if you buy it new, then that would be 3 to 400K.
Why does it have to be lead? Could you just use a lot of concrete?
That's what we paid. Yeah, no iron because you don't want to screw up the LCB.
But it looked like you had a lot of space, and CERN has lots of concrete blocks lying around. Could you fill the space with concrete?
Concrete is actually quite good for neutrons, so that's maybe, it's worth. I think you don't have enough space for all that concrete, but maybe some of it could be concrete.
Okay, I will quickly try and give an overview of the Millikan experiment, which has a prototype here installed. So here's a group of proud installers, some of whom are in the audience, installing this prototype. And I'll tell you a little bit about the experiment, its motivation, and then some of what we've learned from this prototype. So the experiment is a search for fractionally charged particles that could be produced at the LHC, so we're a parasite. The goal, of course, I mean, the motivation is we have not looked there, so we should. Where for us, our parameter space is charge versus mass. There are previous searches at SLAC that cover this range. At the colliders, you can have sensitivity that dies, of course, as the charge gets small. So this region in here is uncovered, and we can target that region. And so that's the motivation, of course. But then a good example of a model-driven motivation is if you have a dark photon that could mix with our photon, that mixing actually can generate a effective charge. So a dark electron would have its charge reduced by the mixing to the photon, so it would look like a fractionally charged particle for the standard model. So you could produce this any way you can produce dileptone pairs, so you could have Drellian production, Of course, it's Q squared, it's charge squared suppressed in the production, but then it's essentially invisible in the detectors once you get below a quarter or a third of the charges. There are explicit searches for fractionally charged particles at CMS. I think there also were, yeah. There are generic limits like that, but explicit searches go after it, but they die off at a third of the charge. Just because you don't even trigger the electronics, even if you could trigger the right. Yeah, it's not about production. It's just the trick, of course, is to find a way to get around this ionization suppression with a specific detector that goes after the very small ionization. So that's what drives the detector design. So this is the sort of picture that our engineer made of the idea. You put together a bunch of bars, and the key is make the bars as long as you can so that you get a lot of ionization even though the charge is small. We're limited by space, so what we have in the end is 80 centimeters long, and then the size, the horizontal size doesn't matter so much other than you just want to cover as much area as you can. And then we have three layers of these, so that and each PMT is then read out with the digitizer, and we look at the waveform of all of them. So here, for example, this is just one event from where you have two single photon hits in one of the bars. And what we're after, the signal, would look like triple coincidence along in line with the beam, which this points projectively down to the collision point. And they would be in line and in time. And then small, of course, the smallest you can go is a single photon, which sets the limit on the smallest charge we can go after.
What's the minimum ionizing? How many photons would you
have? Minimum ionizing here is something like 20,000 photons. So it's not a million. What you'd really want is a million. But you get close, so I'll show you the efficiency a little bit later as a function of charge. Yeah, so you want this as dense and as long as you can get it for a reasonable cost.
Why? So you said you mentioned a million. Why is it not a million, or why would you want it to be
a million? Oh, so if you really have, if you use a thousandth, a millicharge, then a thousandth squared means that a millicharge particle is a millionth of a MIP.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, and then the next, so the thing that drives the design, a lot of what drives the design is try and make it as long as will fit, but what fits is determined by where you put it, and so you want it as close as you can get to the collision point, obviously, because we're not after very long lifetimes. In fact, you want to have these dark fermions not have decayed, and you want coverage. So we looked for a nearby place. And what we're using now is there's a vestigial drainage gallery that goes over the top of CMS. So this is a picture of it here. That was because there's an underground river up here, and while the shaft was being dug, it needed to be frozen with liquid nitrogen, encased in concrete, and then the water drained away. So that's where we live now. This is a view down. So this is the shaft we were talking about earlier, which is empty except for this small cap on the top. This gallery, this drainage gallery, is accessible from a few flights up the elevator shaft, down a small hall. We're actually sitting here, so at about 80 equals zero, which is not where you'd like to be, but it's where we can put it. There is a problem, is that there's actually a tunnel that goes out and opens looking down onto the top of the LHC. So this, although the backgrounds are very low, this is still a radiation environment. Okay, so here's a view in the gallery. So I haven't been there yet. My students and postdocs have been spelunking around in there, but I haven't. This is turning off towards the door, and I think the detector actually will sit back there. It is not the most hospitable environment, but it is a well-aligned survey environment. So the CERN survey team, well, a survey team, I think it might have been the CMS survey team, transferred the CMS, this ends eventually, And there's a hidden valley on the other side through the door here. They have the CMS coordinate system transferred into our detector coordinate system with a precision of about, I think it's a centimeter, right? Which is all that we need. And so here's a picture of them finalizing that. Okay, so that's the sort of the constraints that drive the detector design and the idea. The sensitivity of the detector is shown by these lines in this same space of the charge versus the mass. This is the very first sensitivity estimates that were done in the original paper by these guys proposing the idea. There's since collaboration is built around, and we have put out a letter of intent to install this thing. This is the collaboration now that has simulated so this is an example of a millicharge particle, all of the photons in one bar in the full detector, and there's the efficiency. And you can see it fall like a rock at very small charges because of the length. Okay. So if you put that together, you pretty much get the same answer. So this is what we expect for 300 Emmer-Sumter barns and then 3 Attle barns. Covering this range we were after, of course, dying as the mass goes up just from cross-section. But a key assumption in this is that background is dominated by just random coincidence of dark rate, which is a reasonable expectation if you have this triple coincidence, but we want to make sure we really understand the backgrounds. So we have installed a prototype, a demonstrator.
What's your dark rate in just one of the scenarios?
The dark rate is in each PMT, it depends on the PMT type, but I think we assumed 500 hertz for the dark rate. You can cool them to reduce that. I think that the dominant background is likely to not be just dark rate. There are, because you can actually have a random dark rate or anything else on top of something that's correlated between two of them, right? So the key is we really have to measure this. And we have measured the dark rate in PMTs. It varies depending on just not just PMT type, but PMT. But the key question is to really understand, measure all of these backgrounds, right? For example, what's the background from the beam? And so we did exactly the same thing you guys were talking about. We built a very small prototype back in 2016 that we just left in the underground control room, taking data for a long time and measured a lot of these things. Now this is basically a piece. So this is 1% of the full detector in situ, with the actual final alignment mechanical support that is that we've been taking data with since late 2017. And I'll show you a little bit of what we've learned from that. So the demonstrator, we call it, is a table that sits on this support structure with a pair of PMT, a pair of scintillators in the PMTs, and then in this three-layer structure. And then we just put three of those. We stack it three high, which is what gives us the 1%. Then we need shielding, because we're worried about correlated backgrounds, where you could actually have, say, a radioactive background that gives you correlated hits in two layers. We have some shielding. First, active neutron shield, just a scintillator. And then some lead shielding between the layers here. We then cover the whole thing with a tent of scintillator veto panels and put a tracker in front and behind. So we have some scintillator-based photoscopes that cover the front and the back. And then finally, we had a few extra of these, and so we just put a few on top to allow us to measure some of the, to pick up the small subset of the backgrounds that are well measured and study them. So that's the sketch of what it looks like. Oh, and then we also put some B-field sensors. That's a picture of what it actually is.
Just out of curiosity, so, obviously one of the correlated backgrounds you ordered was like cosmic ray showers and everything, et cetera, and right. You can have some handles on it, because everything lights up, and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So on a detailed level, is there a reason you oriented these trackers perpendicular to the bars?
Yes. So of course, this is for beam particles. These were intended to give us two things. One is a very well-measured set of cosmic rays where we know where it went. We can understand that. And then these two are designed to have cosmic rays that go through, generate something we wouldn't have seen in the detector here. But we actually know it was there. We know where it went.
So they really aimed at the blind spots.
Yeah. And if we had a little bit more time and money, we would have, of course, wanted to have full tracking this way. But you don't need it. You just need to pull out a piece of the background you really understand and study it. So that's the goal. So this is a picture of it. And you can sort of see the tracker. That you can't see the bars because they're covered in the shielding and then the accelerator in between. So, of course, the goal is to really understand, to measure the backgrounds. And I wish I could tell you we're finished with that. We're not. But I want to show you a couple things we've learned so far, mostly from muons, from collisions. So can we see Q equals 1 particles before we can see Q equals 0.001 particles? And so, here's an example. This mechanical drawing I showed you actually wasn't a mechanical drawing. It was our event display, which lights up, which shows the pieces of the detector that have a hit. We just set it up to have everything hit in the previous one. That's a physicist's version of a mechanical drawing. So you have a through-going particle from a collision. And the lead blocks are shown here. That doesn't mean they're hit, not instrumented. So of course we can do a lot with this. Like our main goal is to make sure that we actually can simulate that background properly. So we really want to, what we're doing is a measurement of muons produced in the CMS collisions with a very small muon detector through behind 15 meters of rock. So it's a QCD cross-section measurement, really. So you can see, of course, there are quite a few. These are the beam on particles going out. These are cosmic rays going in.
So those are things like going backwards in the detector?
So this is the time between here and here, just taking the biggest lever arm. And these are where this guy is late by the speed of light from that. And then this is where this guy is late by the speed. Well, this guy's early. So we assume those are cosmic rays coming down, and in fact, if I don't have it here, but if you flip a switch and say, I only want beam on, you get this. You only want beam off, you get this, and a little bit of that. And that little bit of that is just that beam off doesn't mean that there are no collisions, it just means they're not stable. So this is cosmic rays, this is... Sorry, that was a joke. I didn't mean to confuse you. Right. So this is cosmic rays, and you can see that if you look in beam off data, you get this beam off and beam on. You get this. When you look at only the beam on data, then you get a mix of these two. Beam off, you don't see this, except for a tiny little bit, because when the beam is off, it really just means it's not stably colliding, but there's a period of collisions right before it's called stable, and we see them. That was what it meant. Okay, so what can we do with these? Of course, you want to measure the cross-section and the rate. So this is a plot of the number of such through-going particles, the rate per hour as a function of date since the collision started a month or so ago. And you can see all the stores. There's a bit of a hint that you can even see, well, let me pick one where it's easy to see. You can see the exponential decay of the beam. If you get enough statistics by folding all of these on top of each other, then you can actually see the decay of the beam. So it's a crude luminometer. Another way to look at the same thing, where we actually want a cross-section measurement, let's make sure we actually know how to calculate things and they make sense. So we do this for every store. We count the sum of them versus the integrated luminosity for that fill, and it behaves well. And then here's our integrated luminosity plot overlaid on top of the CMS integrated luminosity plot. So these are fun, but the bottom line is, can you actually measure a rate? And so the rate we measure is 180 of Q equals 1 through going per inverse up to barn. The simulation with a crude simulation of the detector and then all of the 15 meters of rock gave us 220. And this is actually too good of an agreement given that this is a QCD effect. And the muons that we see punching out of the back of the rock are much lower momentum than they were before. So there's a lot of PT degradation going on. So the same order of magnitude, which is encouraging. Mm-hmm. So we understand that background.
How many radiation lengths of rock do you have?
15 meters. I don't know what the radiation length of rock is.
That's about 10 centimeters.
10 centimeters. Yeah, we have a lot.
30 or so.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
So it's, I see. So it's a little bit more than what's also in the detector.
I think it's a lot more than what's also in the detector.
I think I computed it at some point. It's essentially similar to what we have, about 30 radiation lengths. Or hydraulic.
Including the detector itself.
Yeah, hydraulic.
That's similar to what's in the detector.
Three times the temperature.
No, it's three times the
atmosphere. That's similar.
No, it goes exponential.
Yeah, it's three times the number of radiation interaction lengths, but it...
No, I know about exponentials. Yeah. That was directed at the theory.
Yeah, so I
forgot what causes these muons again.
So these muons are, I can tell you what this simulated number is.
Yeah.
And the fact that they agree means that that's probably about right.
Yeah.
This is actual muons produced in the collision, but they're mostly QCD with decays to muons.
So they're decay and flight, we might have called
this decay. It's a mix of decay and flight and Bs and everything else. So these are real muons.
Okay.
That are sort of, they have to have at least 20 or 30 GeV to make it that far because of just range out in the concrete.
So they're probably mostly from Ws.
No, they're mostly from QCD. Well, it's all Ws, but yeah, they're mostly just QCD. The actual Drellian muon production is negligible compared to the QCD because any muon pointed in that direction, we don't have any way to filter away with isolation or anything like that. The general purpose detectors, of course, have this huge background of non-isolated muons from jets. That's what dominates us.
This is data-driven? I mean, is it data-driven simulation or?
The
I don't know how you get a cross-section for just muon QCD.
You just run QCD production with some minimum PT, which is, you know, 10 GV or so, because anything with less than 10 GV, if a jet less than 10 GV, wouldn't make it that far.
So you take a jet cross-section, you hadronize it, and then you just count the muons.
Pick out all the muons, swim them through the magnetic field, which doesn't really do anything, because...
Does that agree with the Atlas data, that cross-section?
What?
Can you match that with just, you know, Atlas data?
Oh, so this is a CMS Monte Carlo.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is matched to QCD event to jet data in CMS. Right, and we're just picking out the very rare piece of it that is muons.
Have you thought about trying to correlate the jet pointing at your detector with when you see things?
We would have to have had CMS trigger at the same time.
The triggers are.
And it's right. At some point, we may think about finding a way to correlate the triggers.
You could try to use a single.
Yeah, because that muon is
really
hard.
Yes.
So much.
Well, we could. I mean, this. If I go back, the trigger rate we would add to the budget is 10 per hour. So it's probably okay.
That's true. You could trigger on every rate.
Yeah, but it's the committee work would be a year to get that.
Right. Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. The other thing is the time. We're quite a ways. Out of time, and it's kind of nice to be independent from CMS. So along those lines, this black CMS reported integrated luminosity is the public integrated luminosity, not the internal. I don't know how long it took to actually go find the public one instead of just use the internal one. But just to be clear that we're separate.
David, I want to understand that your sensitivity plot, it was a ways back, and I just wanted to understand it a little better. There's that pretty hard cutoff at, I'm going to call it 50...
Half the Z mass.
It's half the Z mass. So I need to think about that for a second. Okay, so
Psi epsilon Z.
Okay, and is the point that you would be coupling to them, or would this point they provide background?
It's basically any way you could produce leptons through a photon.
Okay.
Right. So I said Drillian, but it's any way you have any place that you have a photon producing dileptons. You could have a dark photon mix on the way in, produce dark sector fermions.
I almost understand that. The one thing is, but then you assume that the Millick charge also couples to the Z via the vector coupling or something? Is that what?
Okay,
so good. I understood one thing. And then, you have the slack one there.
Yeah.
And then what I was just trying to understand, you know, if you were designing an experiment from scratch, you might not have chosen a Hadron Collider to do this experiment at. Is that a sensible thing I just said?
So the LHC mass scale, I mean, this is small compared to the LHC mass scale.
You're right? Making lots of Zs is sort of right. What you're benefiting from here.
You could imagine that if you had a very high rate, some intensity, high intensity of moderate masses.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So what I was really just sort of absorbing was that if you wanted to work at 5 Jev or below, you might consider going to Bell 2 to set up your telescope up at Bell 2. But to get above 5 Jev, you definitely need to be there. Is that a fair, almost fair statement?
Yeah, I think so. And anything else trying to go in between, you actually need a very high rate.
The problem is
there are ways to produce things in this, but not with both the intensity.
Okay.
Okay.
Good. Good.
Yeah,
but the
most of that curve is from on-shell Z. So if you took away the Z in your Bell 2, you're just getting these little extra bumps, and your curve goes.
Yeah, that's what.
It gives you this extra bit.
Yeah, only a little extra on top of this thing, right?
On top of the Drillian.
Yeah, but you have just such an enormous, you may have a big luminosity benefit at Bell. That's what I was actually, because look at the slack millicute. That was a beam dump experiment. Okay.
Yeah.
And presumably Bell 2 does better than a beam dump experiment. Because Bell 2 is optimized for luminosity. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I agree. The low masses, it's not mostly like Z, it's the other thing.
We haven't studied what you would get just from in other scenarios, but
it's a really brutal primary space, right? Like, because your production is epsilon squared, your detection is epsilon squared,
yes.
Times 3, so it's really epsilon to the whatever power. So the fact that the bottomerium or whatever the hadron production mode is gives you that much on that log plot, given that all of that scales epsilon to the 6 or 8, means if it was, you know, if you were to remove the Z, you'd actually move up not as much as one would likely think. So then the Lumi factor could push you over the edge.
Okay, so I have to go see Bell 2 of space.
Like a pixel in epsilon is a ridiculous amount of weight.
Yes, right,
yeah,
right.
It's so brutal.
What would be gained by using more expensive or sensitive scintillators, like scintillating crystals or something?
Yeah, so we looked into that. And I'll cut to the chase, which is at the end. The ballpark estimate we have for the design, the cost estimate for the design we have is 1 to 2 million. And the key also is the time scale. We think that this seems to be working. We can get it in for run 3, for the 300 inverse heptabarons, and then also for this. You could gain by having a denser scintillator. It costs a lot more. If cost wasn't an issue, there's a real benefit in 4-fold coincidence instead of 3. The fact that it's simple, it's just scintillator, there's no gas or wire chambers or anything like that, is really important because it's a somewhat difficult environment. It's better to put something simple in. And we can actually do it in time to take data, not just plan for a future. So denser scintillator, with more money is an option. Anything more complicated than that starts to get a little bit off time shell.
Is it dramatic? Are you going to get below the 1,000 charged?
It can help. I think the key question for us is going to be the backgrounds. Is that actually if you go to 4-fold instead of 3-fold coincidence, then it's smaller, but then you need denser material. This is a log plot though, so it doesn't buy you that much really. and it only helps you on one side of the Q squared problem, not the other side. The production is still Q squared.
I'm going to run another meeting, but let me ask one last question. How much did the prototype cost, and how much would the full thing cost?
So the full thing we estimate at $1 to $2 million. The prototype was scrounged. The PMTs were reused. I think the oscillator was a few K. So it was scrounged. But $1 to $2 million for the whole thing. So I think that actually was the next thing I was going to talk about. I'm done with the. In fact, the summary and outlook. So actually, we have a design that will cover a large part of the charge and mass plane. How much of it is realistic after real understanding of the backgrounds versus the simulation? Don't know, but it's a log plot. So you can lose, and it almost doesn't show up. We actually have engineering and mechanics I didn't talk about, but it's actually a big piece of the work to have the final detector. And we're understanding things with this demonstrator, and we hope to understand the background soon that will then allow us to make small modifications to the design. Small is important because we actually want to be ready for run 3, and so construction and installation during long shutdown 2 is a target. And if funded, we think we can do that, and the cost is $1 to $2 million. That's all. I just want to show a picture of what I guess I can call a milli collaboration because it's small. It's very nice to have a collaboration like this. This is a recent collaboration meeting in New York. Okay, thanks.
So width of that time window where you receive them at the beginning and at the end is pretty wide. Is that because the oscillation occurs somewhere in each of the...
So the time, the
plastics,
time,
I mean, because you should be able to measure time of flight much better than that.
Yeah, the time resolution, oops. The time resolution is 2 nanoseconds mm-hmm. for each hit, and then this requires 2 of them. We could probably do a little bit better by more careful pulse fitting. However, this is the time resolution in these guys.
Yeah.
These have an extra time resolution just from light flight, which is a couple nanoseconds too. So there's a wall at about 2 or 3 nanoseconds, and mm-hmm. getting below that in resolution is hard.
There's no superluminal particles in there.
No.
Well, sorry, go ahead. I've asked like 5 questions.
So if you produce, pair-produce these charged particles with a boost recoiling against the jet, is there ever a possibility of seeing two of them in the same, is the coverage too small?
The coverage is too small because it's a really tiny fraction of the whole thing. And if you were to pair produce them with any opening angle, you know, at very low mass, they'll be near each other, but we're you know, a square meter, 15 meters away. Yes. We thought about whether or not we could see long-lived things decaying in front. Just for fun. Of course, it's a small piece of the parameter space. But it's such a small piece that things like that don't really pay off.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, mine was more general. You said, I'm still trapped on this question where I was tormenting an earlier guy about the Hertzian and missing energy versus detecting.
We're not Hertzian.
Yeah, you're Hertzian, but you produce and detect, right? That's it. And you don't produce, it is your interaction region that produces it.
Yeah, right.
And so it's produced and detected.
It's produced with one hat, it's detected with another.
Yeah, but it is Hertzian. And I mean, the thing that I'm still just generally sort of pondering and trying to understand is, you know, so much was discovered by only detecting the missing, right? Oh, not doing Hertzian. You know, so neutrinos are the most prominent example, tau neutrinos. The great Ellison Wooster experiment that detected neutrinos first in 1927, they're all just produced, not detect. What else?
That's
an interesting question. The W was the neutrino.
No, the W makes leptons.
Yeah, but it was the missing energy really important at UA1.
Okay. No, that's true. But you can construct a kinematic variable that tells you the mass pions. So
in that case, you're detecting the neutrino.
Right.
So missing energy was important. I mean, that's all.
Missing energy is awesome.
Yeah, I'm just sort of grappling with the following simple concept. But you, You guys want to see decays to standard model particles. So I would argue there's some sort of reciprocity theorem. Therefore, you must be able to produce it from standard model particles. You got a lot of flux at the. You have a lot of luminosity of standard model particles at the interaction point. So, and you're further, when you detect, you're only detecting a few percent of all those that are going through your detector, first of all.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's this big upscale factor to get back to production. And I'm sitting here, that's as far as I can get, to sit and think, wait a second, they're producing an awful lot more than they're detecting. Why aren't they seeing, if any of these things is right, why don't you anticipate whopping missing energy signals?
You produce one pretty bad.
But I mean, in our ensemble of samples, you're going to have so many missing energy signals.
So you have to, the picture that you have to have in your head, is that, the LHC collision has an occupancy at any one time of just thousands of random charged particles from pile up, which means that if you are trying to construct the missing energy momentum vector by adding up all the stuff in the detector and seeing where it points, that's how you detect it. The noise level of your measurement is such that you're looking at a dark count of MET, it's almost like a dark count of MET, which is a decaying exponential with a constant in the scale of 50 to 100 GeV, which means that you will see 50 or 100 GeV of MET just because of the hadronic chaos in your collision.
No, but that only triggers, it's what, like 200-ish?
Yeah. The trigger is 200 or 300. So
I mean, neutrinos carry off hundreds of GeV of MET, right?
No, that's right, they do, but that's because if you produce them, well, it depends on the model. If you produce a Z boson that recoils against a jet and the Z decays to two neutrinos, you're sitting pretty because you have a nice big jet and a turn of MET, so you're fine.
Right.
But it's if you produce a Higgs boson, and the Higgs boson is produced in gluon fusion, and it doesn't really require a lot to bounce off of. So you might have 50 GeV of visible energy, and then it decays into missing into invisible particles, and you have 50 GeV of MET.
Right. So the MET really only helps you in that case if you have initial state radiation.
But then
it can boost against, and paying a cost of 100 or 150 GeV is like a factor of 100 or more.
Yeah, I still understand that there, how do you avoid having a kinematically, a set of events that are kinematically give you MET? Okay, many don't, I agree with that. Okay, but, the question that I'm confused about is, isn't it inevitable that every model that would cause a decay in your detectors would produce a class of events that have big MET also?
So maybe it will, but at a cost.
You
have to pay this ISR cost.
It seems like the cost that you don't have to pay, the Hertzian cost of detecting a few percent, and we know they couple to standard model particles because that's how you're
doing it. But without that.
There are cases where it's totally hopeless, right? Suppose I have a B-jet, right? So there's this exotic B decay where you decay one invisible particle. It's like saying I have a B-jet, I need to identify with very high probability that I'm not missing a single K on in the BJET, for instance. Right? And that's just not feasible.
I'm just having trouble with it. It feels like it's incomplete somehow to me, but it might be right. Fine.
The way that the event rates work out, right, is that any kind of MET measurement is going to be, unless you're out way at the tails of 2,000 GB of MET or whatever, if you're sort of in that few hundred GB of MET, you're going to be background dominated. Which means your sensitivity scales with the square root of the amount of events that you make. Whereas in a background-free measurement, your sensitivity is going to scale linearly. So that's the neutrino flow.
Right. The reason LDMX works is because they can send in one electron at a time. The reason LDMX works is because they can send in one electron at a time.
Oh, no, I understand that. Okay. It's tagged.
Right, the point is there's no comparison one can make between LDMX and a hadron collider.
Right. You're smashing together protons and you have 200 collisions happening at the same time, one of which is maybe interesting. Yeah, and then as long as
if it carries 300 GeV of missing energy, you'll detect it.
No, that's right.
But that is an invisible particle to have 300 GeV.
Right. But how do you? The thing that I'm having trouble with is that if it couples to standard model particles, it seems like there's a very simple phenomenological relationship between detection and production, and you can just you don't need complicated models.
But it is 100% of the time in standard model stuff, right? So it's not like you need to interact with the standard model on the other side of the detector. You're not paying, right?
you produce these London particles,
they decay, they're interacting with center model.
Right, but there's no extra penalty you pay.
The penalty is the exponential tail.
You can go back to the vertex and say, if it's decaying at this rate, what must the production cross-section be? That's all I'm saying.
That doesn't scale that way, because that's an art of, like, if you can access a high-energy mediator and get it on shell, yeah, like, you would never produce, if the LHC can make lots of neutrinos by producing on-shell Z bosons.
You already see it in David's plots for Millikan, right? There's the when you can produce these guys in the K of an on-shell Z, sure, a huge rate, and once you go above the Z, your rate drops enormously, right? So if you have a collider that has energy that can produce everything.
Wait, these aren't decaying, first of all.
No, but
okay, I was addressing there's a difference between decaying and interacting.
But Dave was just talking about there are kinematic scenarios in which the production rate can be significant, right?
Okay. So like, if you as soon as that millicharge guy has a mass of 50 JeV, the LHC becomes a low energy experiment for the production of these things, because you don't make the parent particle on shell and you have to live off the virtual propagator. So your cross section drops dramatically. But as soon as you have enough energy to produce the parent particle on shell, you don't pay that off-shell propagator price. And you make oodles more of the parent particles, right, which then decay, yeah, with branching ratio 1, say, into your interesting particle, right, or branching ratio whatever. And then that interesting particle will decay back to the standard model with the propagator suppression, and that's why you have the long lifetime. So there is indeed a relationship between production and decay, but because you're accessing high energies, the effective field theory within which you're comparing couplings are different for production and decay.
Perhaps. I managed to remember the story with heavy neutrinos at PEP.
Okay, sure.
We went through this whole thing with Martin Perl years ago. Okay, and there it was very simple. The production mechanism was through the Z0, right?
Uh-huh.
And then the decay was through, you know, some sort of Kibibo suppressed. It was just a different decay mechanism entirely.
Yeah, sure.
And so the production, I think that's similar to what you're saying. The production mechanism and the decay mechanism were so different that there was no obvious relationship. You know, all those plots were versus UE4 and all these things. Okay, so I'm still, you know, I'm trying to just keep asking because I still don't really quite see it.
I think that's a good time for us to take it off.
That's a good time to take it off. That's right.
Also, for those of you who need to go outside and get a breath of air, Joe's ride will go off however long it takes me to go get my bicycle from Broida and come back. So we'll meet outside in front of KTP from Broida, Old St. Marcos. Otherwise, let's thank all of our speakers again.